Welcome to episode 38 of Leading People with me, Jerry Murray. This episode is brought to you by Wide Circle, helping you make better talent decisions. To learn more, visit widecircle.eu, that's widecircle.eu. What role do illusions play in your decision-making? How can you challenge your illusions so you can make better decisions? And how does a manager with hindsight bias actually prevent his or her team from making good decisions? This week I sat down with magician and mentalist Alex Z to explore the world of illusions at work. During our conversation, we explore how we create illusions, how we're susceptible to illusions created by others, and how we can challenge our illusions to make better decisions. Alex has just published his first book on the topic and was keen to explain how his book is different from others on the subject of decision making. Oh, and stay tuned to the end as Alex has a special offer for some lucky listeners. So, without further ado, let's hear what Alex has to say. Alex C, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Jerry. It's really great to be part of this show.
Great. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. I saw you perform recently, and I was quite, really impressed by what you did with an audience in a very short space of time. So I thought, I have to get this man on the show. And as it happens, by the time this airs, there will be a new book out as well. So that'll be even more things to look forward to. But for people who don't know who you are, what you do, etc., maybe we could start with, how did you get to where you are today? Because I know you didn't start off where you are today. And was there any person or place or an event or that stands out on your journey to where you are today? Or was there sort of an epiphany moment where you just went, my God, that's my destiny? So maybe share with our listeners a little bit about how it all happened, because and they don't really maybe know yet what you do, but it's quite fascinating.
Yeah, so to make it short, today I'm a magician, mentalist, and a corporate speaker. So I help events to become more memorable and also help companies to be better decision makers by understanding the illusion that can hinder the decision that we make. And as you said, I didn't start as a magician. That was definitely not an option that I had in my mind. I was trained as an IT engineer. I have a 15 years career in many companies as an IT engineer. And when you ask about an epiphany moment, no, I don't think, well, you know, I met a master magician called Eugene Berger, who is no longer with us, unfortunately. He died a few years ago. And he told us at some point that looking back on his life, he realized that he didn't choose magic, but it was magic that chose him. And to me, I must admit that I don't know, but maybe I will say the same things in 10 or 20 years, because I never intended to become a magician. Magic, I was not interested in magic when I was a kid, not when I was a teenager. Magic came to me when I was a young engineer, through the form of one of my colleagues who performed magic as a hobby. And one defining moment, I would say, that I definitely know for this was that evening that we had. It was kind of corporate evening in the restaurant. There was a magician at the cocktail part of that dinner, and I don't remember what that magician did, except something that was really not suited for the corporate environment. So not a bad thing, not a good thing to reproduce, really a bad thing. But I had that colleague that I've been working with for a few months, and I didn't know I was doing some magic. Some other colleagues knew that and asked him at the end, could you perform something? And that guy was just in front of me. That guy's Mark, if he's listening. We never know. And I remember that he performed three performances of magic. One was really a strong feeling of magic plus a really interesting story. And at that moment, I kind of heard a voice in my head telling me that if he can do that, I can do that too. No? And so I started to learn a bit about magic, and but still it was not that the passion that I have today for this art. It was kind of a hobby. It was fun to be the magicians of the company when every month we had a corporate event. But then I moved to Belgium, to a different context, different mindset, different culture, different company. And even though that magic was, I kind of lost the interest in magic. And then I gained it back, then lost it, then getting back, then lost it. It was really like something that was not there to last. But at some point I met a magician here in Belgium who is now a friend, who introduced me to the work of Eugene Berger, the master that I was mentioning earlier, and Jeff McBride. And he told me that studying with those master magicians changed his magic forever. Yeah. And he was a magician, kind of guy that started when he was really a kid, continued as a teenager, and became a professional magician. And it's true that the work of Eugene, especially, because those were the first work that I encountered, were really interesting because Eugene, before becoming a master magician, or just a professional magician, was a professor, university level, in theology, in history of religions. So he was already interesting with what he was sharing. Because he was not sharing like magic as this is all about a trick. He shared pieces of wisdom. He shared interesting stories. And those stories were enhanced with magic.
Yeah.
And I think that was the hook for me.
No.
But still, that was not when I wanted to become a professional magician. It was more like when I was kind of not bored with my job, but I didn't find the job that I wanted to do in IT. And I said, okay, I think it's time to go for entrepreneurship. And I wanted to do something regarding public speaking and coaching people and helping people to become better public speaker. And magic came back. Nice. And I had the opportunity to kind of becoming a professional magician. And that's where I am now. So that's why I say it's long story short, like and maybe in 10 or 20 years that I will say the same thing as Eugene, that maybe magic chose me. I don't know.
You said something interesting I want to build on. I mean, mm-hmm. I've been to see several magic-type presentations at a more business-orientated environment, right? Mm-hmm. And I've always been impressed at what an audience can learn. So it's not just entertainment. There's lots more that can be unpacked. But the thing that struck me was you talked about this art called magic. However, if there is also the science on the other side,
yes.
not maybe in terms of science of the way, but there's a science in the brain coming into play here, which helps this art form work really, really effectively. So maybe we can start to explore, before we get to the book, because I want to get to the book. I'm sure a lot of this is in the book, but we'll get to the book in a minute. But like, what is going on in the brain when a magician is up there in front of us? We all kind of, to use an English term, we all fall for it, right? And when the magician has delivered what we think is the punchline, there's always another punchline to come, because this is fascinating. So what's going on in what's going on in the brain? Because you talk about illusions. You say you're really, when it comes to teaching the world about this and not just performing magic, it's really about the illusions we create in our brain. So tell our listeners a bit about this, what you've discovered.
Yeah, I think that the part of the engineer part of me that wants to understand things and want to use those things to help the world become a better place. And that's true that the first time I traveled to Las Vegas about 10 years ago, I had the chance, the luck, I don't know how to call it, to attend a talk by Stephen McNeick, who is a neuroscientist. And he was speaking about the book he wrote with his partner in crime, Susana Martinez-Conde, who is also a neuroscientist, about neuroscience and magic. Mm-hmm. Because those two neuroscientists said that they felt really that they were too limited in the lab to study the brain. And they thought about partnering with magicians regarding the illusions to have all the participants in their studies to really have a strong illusion so that they will be able to better understand the brain. And that started me on the path on, okay, what is exactly the link between magic and science? Because as you said, there is science behind what everything is happening when you are attending a magic show. However, the science not always get back into magic because there are a few scientists who really study that. One who is really, really strong with that is Gustav Kuhn.
Yes, I know his work. He's in London, isn't he?
Yes. And he wrote the book Experiencing the Impossible, The Science of Magic. And I had a discussion with him where he said, you know, magicians, for thousands of years, they have studied human beings. And by studying human beings, they've understood kind of the limitation that we all have. And they play with those limitations. But the way you learn those limitations when you are learning the art of magic, it is more like, do this because this works. Yeah, it may seem strange, but this works. And it works because this and that. Mm. And he said, yes, but when you say this works because X and Y, nothing has been really tested on the scientific level. It is more like empirical study that, yeah, we've done that and that works. And we think it works because of that, but when we share that, we forgot to say that we think it works. We say yes, it works because of that. And he has created a lot of studies to challenge those things. And sometimes he found really fascinating things. And we had a class at the mystery school where he shared those studies, and it was just like really, really incredible. And so getting back to your question about what happens when you are experiencing a magic show, so many things happen.
Right.
But the thing that is really fun is that all those things that happen during a magic show happen in everyday life, because that is exactly the way we perceive the world that is at stake when we are performing a magic show. So when you study in how the brain process all the visual elements that we receive, we see a lot of things, but do we see them really? We all have that experience that we've been at a moment, at a party, at work, whatever, we had a discussion and someone tells you, oh, did you notice that? And in fact, you didn't. But it was right in front of your nose. That maybe it was like, I don't know, a stain on a dress or a pant of a colleague, but you didn't pay attention to that. You were paying attention to something else. And understanding how that works, you realize that this is really not specific to magic. Of course, in magic, we exploit those kind of hacks or loopholes in the, not really loopholes, but the way the brain works. We exploit that in a way to create the impossible, to create an illusion. But on an everyday basis, we are creating that illusion already, because we don't perceive everything. Well, our brain cannot perceive everything that we receive, everything that we see, everything that we smell, everything that we hear. It has to select the most important ones. And the way we select the important ones, well, will define the reality that you will experience.
So what are some of the ways in which we decide what's important to us, and that maybe a magician is also leveraging in the act?
One key thing that neuroscience revealed is the power of attention. You can kind of summarize it in a way that where you put your attention to, that will become part of your reality. And everything that escapes your attention will not be part of the reality. And you might not even consider that this might be part of what is real and what should be part of the reality. And I know that in magic, there are a lot of people who know the term misdirection. So the idea of a magician or a scam artist or a con artist, whatever, who distracts you to look at some or to be attentive at some point when he is doing something at another point where you are not looking at it. The same technique for pickpockets, for instance. Mm. You have a pat on the shoulder, on the right shoulder, and you focus on that pat of the right shoulder, and you are not paying attention to your left back pocket, where you have your wallet. But misdirection, in fact, was a term that was coined in magic many, many years ago, many centuries ago. And when you realize all the attention work and what neuroscience found about the attention, you realize that it is not misdirection. Mm-hmm. What we do as magicians is we control the attention.
Yes.
We focus your attention on something because we want your attention to be focused there. Mm-hmm. Maybe we will do something sneaky where your attention is not set, or maybe we just want to focus your attention because if you don't focus your attention there, you will not experience the illusion. For instance, if I want to create the illusion that I put a coin in my hand and the coin disappear, mm-hmm. if I don't direct your attention to see the coin in my hand, mm-hmm. well, you cannot experience the illusion that the coin will disappear if you don't know the coin was there in the first place. Mm-hmm. So I have to direct your attention first to you for you to see the coin and to really believe that the coin is in my hand. And then I can create the illusion that the coin disappears.
Yes. So, this is all fascinating now, because...
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm answering exactly your question. I'm opening a lot of sidetrackings, but you tell me.
It depends on how well I've directed your attention, whether you answer my question or not, I guess.
Anyway, yes.
what strikes me then is, let's take this a little bit into the world of work and organizations, and maybe let's mm-hmm. start with the leader,
yeah.
who is... So it's quite possible that a leader can be directing attention in such a way that they are creating illusions for mm-hmm. others on their team, or that their attention is being, let's say, taken off to the side and actually they're not seeing something that they yeah. possibly should be or could be seeing. So how does that play out? Do you have any examples of how that you've come across that through your work with organizations and a lot of the workshops you do?
Well, I think we have that in three different areas, that is communication, collaboration, and decision-making, that if we don't understand that the way our brain works is kind of the same of creating an illusion. And I think that sometimes what we call reality is just another illusion. It is the reality your mind created based on what's he assumed was important. And if you don't understand that, you will miss things. That you will, when you are interacting with someone and you have a conflict, you have a difficulty that you have a problem to solve, and you say, okay, but that person is completely uncooperative, or that person is just a prick or an a-hole or whatever. Maybe there is something else. And probably there is something else. But when you are stuck in that reality that this person is someone I cannot work with, that person is unprofessional, that person doesn't have a structured mind, or that person is just too woo-woo, whatever you are saying to yourself about that person is creating an illusion that will reinforce that and that will not help you solve the conflict. Because you will stay in that mindset, in that view, in that perspective, in that illusion that person is XYZ, whatever. And maybe if you were understanding that this is an illusion, you were considering that maybe there is something else. And if there is something else, what could it be? And maybe it's XYZ, but maybe it's also plus A, plus B, plus C. Maybe there is also MNN, OP, whatever.
That's right.
But understanding that the reality is richer than what you think it is can help you really understand how other people interact, how the other people work together, and also how your brain can trick you in making decisions.
Yeah. And I suppose the emerging advice from this is to particularly a situation, let's just take what you just talked about, where there's a bit of conflict. Mm-hmm. So there's something yeah. at stake here where you're not able to move forward, let's say, just for simplicity, yeah. right? Is rather than digging your heels in and trying to convince yourself that you're right and they're wrong, and you know, this classic. Yeah. It's the kind of, you know, sometimes I use this concept of take a view from the balcony and look at the dance floor from up there, because what you're going to do is you're going to see some, you're going to take another angle on the challenge, and it takes a bit of effort to do that, because we really have to catch ourselves and go, if I'm going to continue the way I'm continuing, I may make no progress, and I need to be prepared to step out and find another way to process that situation, because my filtering has created a frame around it, and that frame may be actually not helping, right? What can people do to improve that capability?
Well, I think the first thing is to really understand that you might be a victim of illusions. And in fact, it is not might. It is you are a victim of illusions. Now, sometimes the illusions are really important. Something that I want to reinforce to those people who are not familiar with what I'm talking about is that our brain creates illusion, and that's okay. And that's completely normal. And that the way our brain evolved to help us survive. So there are really a lot of good things about our brain creating illusions. It is just understanding that sometimes those illusions really becomes a trap. And you really have to understand that. If you don't understand that, you will be stuck forever, because you will not understand the reality you are trapped in a way. And when you once you understand that, you can start to understand, okay, when do I want to challenge those illusions? Because, well, it would be completely idiot to try to challenge our illusions on an everyday basis, on every second basis. But when we have something that is important, when we want to achieve something, I think it is important to just have a break and think about, okay, how will I challenge those illusions? Because this is important to me, because I want that relationship to work. I want that project to succeed. I want to make the best decision possible. So what could be the illusions? And maybe you would have to study those a little bit. And how could I challenge those illusions? We understand that those illusions can happen.
Yeah. We're into this these concepts of beliefs and assumptions now, aren't we, that are maybe
in a way,
facilitating.
Yeah, sometimes it is. Assumption is definitely the right word. Beliefs, well, is a stronger word, but in a workplace, I don't think it is so much about belief. It is more about assumptions and not understanding those are really assumptions. To tell you a story, for instance, in my the last job that I had at the company, as a 19 engineer, part of my job was to facilitate between teams in Brussels, Belgium, and Paris, France. So you have cultural mindsets that are completely different. I know both of them because I'm French, I worked in Paris, and then I moved to Belgium. And I remember that a lot of the conflict that happened and occurred between the teams in Paris and the teams we had in Brussels mostly were due to communicating only via emails. When you have an issue, it escalated to the manager, N plus one, N plus two, whatever. And my job as a facilitator was a lot of the time just, okay, you have this conflict. Okay, let's take 30 minutes together. Explain me the conflict that you have. You are not able to do this. You want to do that. Okay, and tell me the reasons why you want to do that. And how do you think you are blocked by the other team? All right. I will now go to the other team. Okay, there seems to be a problem with that team in France. Tell me, what is the problem on your perspective? What do you want to achieve? Why do you have that position that you defend to them? Okay, good. Another 30 minutes. And then I plan a meeting with both teams. And I start, okay, I met with both of you individually. Team in France, you told me that you want to do this, you had that problem, and you want this to happen, this is really important. Team B, Belgium, you have that goal, you have that problem, and you want to achieve this. Do we agree on that? Okay, what do you think about that? And just asking that question and having just a little bit of time to understand that, okay, the other is not just against me. It has also goals and priorities, and I have to deal with that. And sometimes, that's the most amazing thing, that a lot of time those goals were the kind of the same. We want to achieve the same thing for the company. Or we have goals that really reach out. But because we were just discussing via email on a specific problem, that I want you to do this. No, I won't. I cannot do that. You have to do it. No, I cannot do that. I will ask manager for you to do it. You are not seeing the perspective and understanding, okay, what is the bigger picture in fact? And just having that little conversation annihilated the conflict. The conflict was no more after they just exchanged that and said, okay, oh, you have that goal. Okay, but I have that goal too. Oh, so maybe, in fact, because you have that restriction, we could do it that way. And most often my reaction, internal reaction, because I could not display that too much, it was, why haven't you asked the question earlier? Because this has been a problem that has been lasted for months. And well, if we wanted to just analyze the cost of that, that would be too much for the company to just have a conflict for something that was, in the end, not a conflict. It's just different perspective and not understanding the other perspective. And then, and assuming that the other was was your opponent in a way.
Yeah. And then you get into this whole idea that, I mean, email is a very useful tool on many situations. It's just knowing when it's not useful. And the thing, email, I often laugh at this when people say I didn't like the tone of that person's email. But emails are, effectively words, what's happening there is that when I interpret those words, the emotional reaction I get to that type of word makes me feel uncomfortable. Sometimes a conversation would, when you add in that meta level of communication, the conversation, that person may not have had a strongly negative emotion at all associated with those words, the person sending the message. Yeah. But we can also sometimes interpret it because those words, whatever mean for us. So I guess there's a learning there that if you stay entrenched in your emails, you're reinforcing the illusions that on both sides. And often those two illusions might even be trying to represent the same thing, just in different ways, right? Because that's what it's often
the same thing. Anyways, that reminds me that when I was training as an IT engineer, it was in the early 2000s, so internet was something quite new. At least in France, I discovered that like maybe two years before starting my study. It was really something really young, and I saw in a way I saw happening the rise of smileys, and how we can add emotions to the text. And many times before having those smileys, when I was having a chat with fellow students, friends, not family, because it wasn't it was not that it was too geeky at that time. It was often that just having a chat with, like we have everywhere nowadays, with those short messages, it was easy to misinterpret what the other was saying. And sometimes it escalated really quickly to something that was completely stupid. and just train those smiley, ASCII smiley. So just when we didn't have these pictures, we just had the normal characters, you know, the old way of doing smileys. Just adding that helps you understand, okay, that person is being ironic there. So I should not take the words for what they are, but I should analyze that with a second or third level, that it is that person is trying to make a joke. But without that kind of smiley, that fun smiley that you had at the end, the words might be really strange or maybe harmful sometimes.
They sometimes used to call them emoticons as well as...
That's
a technical term.
Yeah,
and then if you look, I've come across people who advise on communications. Mm-hmm. They say, no, you don't use these things in professional communications. So now you get into a sort of, if they help sometimes soften up or help explain the underlying intention of the communication, that, as you say, it could be ironic or whatever. Sometimes they can add. But listen,
It is also understanding to that when you are starting to write an email and that email starts to be a bit too long, maybe email is not the right medium. Maybe you should call that person or you should plan a meeting, but maybe not write that long email that you want to write. And if you don't want to use smileys or if you want to be really squeaky clean in your text, you have that corporate talk that is just non-human in a way, and that will not help you reach the goal that you want to achieve with writing that email. So sometimes I always remember that was kind of the rule that I have, that when I start to write an email that is too long and that is not length of a report or a summary or something like that, I ask myself, is email the right tool? Maybe I need to call to organize a meeting, to whatever, to do something else, to go on with my ideas.
So I suppose to just wrap this this little piece up, we are actually creating sometimes illusions with our emails in terms of how we send them, or any form of communication, but particularly things like emails. Now, listen, what I wanted to get to now is the book. Let's get to the book. So the listeners are probably going, where's the book? So tell us what was the purpose of writing this book, and what can our listeners get out of it when they get their hands on a copy and read it? Coming up, Alex explains why he decided to write a book on decision-making and the impact that cognitive biases can have on the quality of our decisions. He outlines how his book is different from other books on the subject and how a manager with hindsight bias affects the decision-making of his or her team. So, back to our conversation.
So, to get a copy, it is easy. It is everywhere where you buy books, usually. So Amazon, right. Fnac, whatever, your local librarian should have that book or should be able to get it to you.
So
one quick disclaimer because we are speaking English and the book is in French. So far, it is not in English yet. It is not complex French, but I want to mention that to those people who don't understand French at all, because you never know. But the story of the book is really focusing about decision making. Throughout my career, I've always been fascinated with how our brain works, obviously, and magic helped me explore that. All the psychology of how we collaborate, how we communicate, and that's led me to study the field that is known as in psychology, the cognitive biases. And I know that you mentioned that a lot also in your talks and in your work, Jerry. And those biases really, well, there are so many of them, but when you try to categorize them and how they can prevent things, you realize that it can prevent communication, it can also collaboration, sorry, and it can prevent also decision making. And because I was involved as an engineer over the last part of my career as an engineer about many decisions, I was really interested to understand more what was those traps. And the book is really kind of a compilation of everything that I know about those biases, and most importantly, how to counteract them. Because I think there are so many books, talks, podcasts, or whatever that speak about cognitive biases that give you kind of a list, sometimes really exhaustive, sometimes not exhaustive, but end at the part, okay, I've explained you what are the biases. You have this, it works in that, and now you're good to go. Well, no, that doesn't work like this, because those biases are so automatic. It is another kind of illusion that our brain creates, because it is an illusion. If you just know there is an illusion, okay, but if the illusion is still happening, you know, like any I would say optical illusion. Optical is not the, well, it is the word that everybody knows. The optical illusions usually are not optical illusions. They are visual illusions because that is the brain that is full, not the eye. But when you experience a visual illusion or an optical illusion, even if you know this is an illusion, mm-hmm. you cannot see anything else than the illusion.
Yeah.
I mean, well, you can think of any illusion that you've experienced, the illusion that you have an image that is still and you feel that it is moving. The image where you have kind of a grid and you see red dots in the corner, and when you look, there are no red dots. You can think about the Adler's checkerboard, where you see two little square on the checkerboard that are a complete different color, and we can prove you that those are exactly the same color.
Same color, yeah.
When you are in the right context, even if you know this is an illusion, you cannot see anything else but the illusion. And that's usually what is really disturbing about the visual illusion, because we understand that this is an illusion, and still we see the illusion. And those cognitive biases are kind of a mental illusion. So that means that with a visual illusion, I can challenge that. I can change my perspective. I can move. I can use touch. I can use a lot of tools to understand that, okay, this is an illusion. Okay, what I see is not really what I see. What it is not really what I see, to be more exact. But when you have an illusion that is between your brain and your brain, like a cognitive bias, how do you do to change your perspective? You cannot really have a grasp, or you cannot really understand that an illusion is happening, because it is automatic, because it is a mental illusion, because you really have no grasp about that. So ending on, here is a list of biases, and now you're good to go, is a kind of another illusion. The illusion of, because we understand that, because we have the knowledge, it is enough. That's kind of another illusion about knowledge.
Okay.
So I think we need to understand, sometimes we need to challenge those illusions, those cognitive biases, and we need tools to challenge those specific biases. So the book was really kind of a compilation. It has three parts. I take the reader from point zero, that the first part is you have illusion, your brain tricks you. Let's dig into what are those illusions. And I describe some cognitive biases. And then what we can do to avoid those traps created by those illusions. Those are really the three phases that I go through in the book. And I created the book because I don't know many books that speak about that. Some books say, okay, how to make better decisions, but they are kind of a really too high-level perspective. And that's not really helpful on a day-to-day basis or on a corporate job. And some don't really explain why you should use those tools. So then you are kind of suspicious about using those tools, or you are not really inclined about using those tools. And some other books explain, okay, what are the illusions that we fall for? Mm-hmm. But they not explain, okay, what we could do or what are the implications regarding decision making in that matter. So it is really a compilation about your brain tricks you. Let's dig into why, what we know already in psychology about that, and then what you could do to prevent those tricks to happen and to become traps.
Okay. So what I'd like you to do for our listeners is to take one or two of those cognitive, or sometimes people refer to unconscious biases, but take one or two of them and just give our listeners one or two insights and tips on something they could do if they experience that bias. Now, the only thing I would say is that it's kind of important to point out that these biases are actually very useful for a lot of things, because they help us process the world around us. It's when they're tripping us up, when they're getting in the way, we need to be able to understand them and challenge them. And this is, you are going to share now, I hope, a couple of little tips for people to say, well, here's a typical bias that comes up in these types of ways. Here's something you could do to test out and maybe change your approach to that bias when you feel that it's not working for you.
Okay, let's try, because I don't describe a lot of biases, because I know, well, you know, depending on how you classify the biases, you have between 150 and 200 cognitive biases that are known. That's too much to just go through all of them, and all of them don't relate to decision making, or at least on a corporate level. So I selected only a few that are really interesting. We could speak about the confirmation bias, but I think a lot of your listeners will know this one, because it's kind of the superstar of the biases, the way that the tendency we have to just confirm what we already believe or assume to be true, or sometimes want to be true, and limit ourselves to that. But one that is... Can we take that one for a second?
Let's take that one.
Okay.
So let's just play with that one, because it is so probably well known. How do we do that, and what can we do? So just expand that, because people might be going, confirmation bias, yeah, maybe, what is that? So there's ways in which we actually actively seek out to confirm things, right? So what are some of the ways in which we do that? For example, social media, for example, is actually feeds the confirmation bias in some respects, doesn't it? Because people get into a channel, the algorithm learns their preferences, and so if in case people are not sure what the confirmation bias is, you know, a little bit of expanding on that, and then here's a few things you could do to maybe mitigate the impact of this one, and then we'll get another one or two before we finish.
Okay. So let's imagine that you think that one particular solution is the solution that you need. A CRM, a podcast software, you name it. The solution, that solution that you've read in a magazine, in a book, that you heard from someone you trust, tells you that, okay, you have that problem. This solution is the solution that you need. Most of the time, what you will do, you say, okay, I will try to challenge a little bit this. And what you will do, you will research. How does this solution can help me solve that problem? But this is just trying to confirm what you've heard.
Yeah.
That, asking that question, how can that CRM software, all that podcast software will help me solve that problem, will not help you understand that maybe there are other kind of solutions. For instance, I was involved once in a project where the legal team of the company wanted to have an AI software that would be able to recognize the text, to go through a lot of contracts that the company had, and to understand when those contracts need to be updated. Okay, fair enough. And they started and came to us, the IT department. Okay, how can you help us select the best AI solution that will help us analyze the contract? That's a good question, and that's something definitely to research. But coming to the IT department with that question, preventing them to ask the question, okay, we need to analyze the contract. What solutions could exist and help us solve that problem? And I was involved in that project when they were already been deep in discussions with, I think it was IBM at that time, or whatever the IT software vendor. And it was not really conclusive because, well, you didn't have enough contract to train the AI, whatever. And when I arrived in that project, it was like, okay, what do you want exactly to do with those contracts? Okay, to search those specific terms in those contracts. So maybe you don't need that AI to really understand exactly what the contract is all about. Just need something, maybe a little tool, just to analyze those text elements that you think are important. And maybe we can combine that with other softwares. And so I opened the door to maybe there are other things. Maybe I really challenge in a way the confirmation bias they had that AI solution exactly is the solution that we need. Maybe not. Another example that I have read in many years ago in in a book that was really interesting about how we make requirements, especially in the IT field. What we call requirements is usually, well, you have a department in the company who wants to do something and they write a document for the IT department. We want to do this and we need a software that does this, 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 and this, and that. Mm-hmm. And he challenged that even in hospitals. And I think it was really interesting at some point that he shared the example of an hospital who say, okay, we're creating a tender for software vendors. We want maybe not software, but at least vendors for hospitals. Because it was surgery, it was not software. But whatever, we create a tender. We want a solution that could be operated with feet.
With what?
Okay, with the feet. Because when you are a surgeon, for instance, your hands are busy. And you want to operate the machine or whatever, or software or piece of equipment, not with the hands.
Okay.
Okay, but when they create a tender and when they think that, okay, the solution that you can use when you cooperate with the feet are really the right solution, they forget to ask or to frame the requirement in a way that it is, they didn't need a machine that was operated by feet. They needed a machine that was not operated by hand. But by asking and by thinking that operating by feet is the thing that they want, they just try to look for the solution that were operating by feet. So it is really, they try to confirm that the idea and went deeper in that idea that we want the thing operated by feet. But this disqualified some providers of solutions where you use, for instance, the voice. Or eye movement or whatever, but something that was not the feet. And maybe that those vendors maybe had the solution that were most interesting, most powerful, most adequate to their needs.
So what I'm hearing is there's underneath both of these examples is how you define what you perceive to be the problem you're trying to solve, and then what kinds of questions you ask in terms of how you might go about this without jumping into a solution and then getting stuck in confirmation bias, for example, saying, well, you know, and often what happens then is you've got the sunk cost fallacy kicking in, because if they invest a lot of time and effort in it, then they don't want to, for those who don't know what that is, the sunk cost fallacy is when you often continue doing things, even though it's bringing you no more benefit whatsoever, but because you've sunk the money into it, you kind of keep going, and often you just keep spending more money.
We cannot stop after having invested all of that. We could not have done this, all of this. We cannot have worked for years and years to reach that position to just drop it out. We could not have done this for nothing. That's the sunk cost fallacy, indeed.
So, give us one more example, and then I think we'll wrap up the conversation. So,
but that's really fun. Nice, you are really a mind reader, because I was thinking about the sunk cost fallacy. Yeah, because strangely, this one is not really that known. But I think it is because it is really strongly linked to the inside bias that we have.
But Alex, let me stop you for a second, because you're a mentalist. So I think you planted the thought in my head. Okay, so this one you wanted to say.
No. No, because we are exploring and talking about, okay, the confirmation bias. We can speak about the sunk cost fallacy. We can speak about the inside bias. One thing that is also interesting to realize is that a lot of the time we speak about biases as if they were expressing themselves all by themselves, all alone, but only the confirmation bias is expressing itself in that situation. But the reality is that they combine with each other in any situation. It is not just one biases that is expressing itself and not the others. It is a combination of that. Sometimes they counteract themselves automatically, but sometimes they reinforce themselves and reinforce the illusion. So the sunk cost fallacy, as you really clearly explained, I think is linked to the inside bias that we have. That is our tendency when we look at a situation, when we look back, at a situation, we see, okay, it was easy. It was easy to understand what we needed to do. Yes. 6 months, 3 months, 2 years, 10 years after that, it is easy to see what you needed to do 3 months, 6 months, 1 year, 10 years ago. But when you were in that situation, it might not have been that easy. You know, that's kind of the fallacy that you see a lot with historians. When you have historians who tell you that it was really predictable to see that the French Revolution was about to happen. Because you have that and this and this in that region of France, we have that. You had that issue with the church. You had that issue with the king. Whatever, they are connecting the dots. Mm. But for the people who were living at the era of the French Revolution, maybe it was not easy to see the dots because the communication was not clear. Because maybe it was just a far bet on some things. Maybe it was just one person and that was brilliant thinker who thought about something, but you could not predict that that thinker and that those thoughts will catch up with everybody. It's really difficult when you are in the situation to always know what you have to do, what are exactly the elements that are important. And sometimes I think that also prevent the decisions from us from making decisions, because I've seen a lot of people in companies, and you've probably experienced that, and our listeners also experienced that, I think, the decisions that last forever. You know, we have been working on that decision for 3 months, 6 months, 1 year. Yes, and why haven't you made that decision? Mm-hmm. Well, I still need something. Well, I'm not sure if it is right. Most often, when I've encountered that, it was a fear that was expressing itself. Mm. And it was the fear of being judged in 3 months, 6 months, being judged retrospectively, being judged with insight, having their manager telling them 6 months after, when the results were not there, you made the wrong decision. You made a bad decision. You should have considered this element. Yes, so but maybe 3 months ago, that element was not known, or maybe that element was not that important. And that's something to really look out for when you see that the decision is not being made. Maybe there is that fear that you will be judged and you will feel that is not just, that is not right. Because you've made everything possible to make the right decision and you are judged on something that maybe you could not just know at that moment.
So interestingly, the way you've articulated that is I think is quite powerful, because what you're kind of saying is this hindsight bias that kicks in. If you have a manager or a leader who is constantly running that and telling people, like, yes, the historian, why and how everything happened the way it did, and how people never see things that they, yeah, you know, we have an expression in Ireland about hindsight, and I can't repeat it on this podcast, but
I want you to tell it to me after the podcast.
anybody out there who wants to know about it, you can buy me a beer or a glass of wine sometime and I'll tell you. But the thing is, you have this situation where if you have a manager or a leader who constantly has this beautiful hindsight, always has, you know, the ability to tell you what should have or could have been done, you're going to withhold, as you say, you're going to, out of fear, out of, you know, you're not going to feel
safe. And you will never make the decision because you want to be sure that nothing can get back to you in the future. And usually, well, that's something that is kind of impossible. When you have a decision that is complex, there are a lot of things that are not known, a lot of unknowns, and you cannot be 100% protected.
Okay, so let's leave our listeners now with, let's synthesize this into a couple of two or three key points that they can take away from this conversation now. Apart from those who speak French, going out and buying the book, those who would like to buy the book, who want to wait for the English version, put in your order to Amazon or somewhere, or to the publisher, and say, we want the English version.
But yeah, would be, yeah. Like, so, that, things, so that my editor will tell me, okay, let's do a translation. And say, yes.
So just just a couple of things that you think our listeners could take away from this. And then I know you've got a special offer for our listeners, but let's do the couple of tips first, and then we'll explain to people how they can get the special offer.
In the final few minutes, Alex provides us with his top tips for challenging our illusions and how to get his special offer.
One tip is really to, I think, acknowledge that we are victim, or at least we live in a world of illusions. And sometimes those illusions will be traps, and we will become victim of that illusion, of those illusions. And I think it is sometimes difficult. It is kind of the same thing of when you start self-development, or when you start to work with a psychiatrist or psychologist, to acknowledge that maybe the world that you see, the vision that you have, and the vision that you've built over the years, maybe is not completely correct. And that might be difficult. So that, I think, really is important to really acknowledge that, okay, maybe if it is not completely pleasant, we live in a world of illusions. And we can experience that in many ways. You can enjoy that at a magic show, but you can really start to study and try to understand why those illusions happen. You could start with only visual illusions. Yeah, why do we experience those visual illusions? Like the Adelson checkerboard. Why do I see those two squares of different colors where they are the same? Let's try to dig a little bit. How our brain sees things, in fact. And by understanding that, sometimes you really understand that things are a bit more complex than there seems to be. And this can ease to acknowledge, okay, because it is more complex and I cannot always understand everything interpret or assume that everything is complex. By understanding that it is complex, maybe it becomes easier to acknowledge that, okay, I have that illusions. And that's okay. Once again, it is okay to have those illusions. It is just that sometimes they play tricks on us. And when the result of those tricks doesn't please us, we should be able to challenge those illusions so that we get the results we want. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to find only three tips because we discussed about so many things in the podcast. Yeah. Well, one thing is to get the book for those who read French, or to watch the videos that I've put up. Some are in English, or those that are not in English are subtitled in English. And usually I try to make to supervise the translation so that I know it is a good translation. But just try to start to study a little bit those kind of illusions. Why we think what we think. So we can books. You can read books that are interesting. I think one that is quite easy to read and really interesting is the book Predictably Irrational by Dan Ariely. Dan Ariely is a behavior economist, researcher, and he has also many talks on TED.
Yep.
So this is another way to start up with the works of Dan. But Predictably Irrational is, I think, really good, especially because the title says it all. We are not rational. There are so many tricks. Another, if you are more interested in the science of the brain, one that is also interesting is Brain Rules by Dr. John Medina. It is kind of an old book, but it goes into those few lessons about the brain and how the brain works, and you will understand about memory, about how stress impact the brain, how sleeps also impact the brain, how different we are, and how similar we are depending on the situations. Those are really interesting. And if you want to have more magic and understand about the psychology behind magic, the book by Gustav Kuhn is really interesting, The Experiencing the Impossible, The Science of Magic.
Yeah, and I've watched some videos of his. He's very articulate. It's very
There's also indeed there is a lecture from him that is public at London College, I think. That is kind of a 1 hour long. That is really also interesting to get started on the works of Gustav. That's a good entry point indeed.
Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to put some links to various things in the show notes. Your book will be out by the time this podcast goes. Gets aired.
Yes.
And how can people get in contact with you, like LinkedIn or something? Can people?
Yeah, the easiest would be on LinkedIn, I think. And
I'll put a link.
Maybe we put the link to my profile on the podcast info. Otherwise, you just search for Alex C. So Alex, and then S I, and you will probably find me. And I usually post also content, so that's another way if you want to get accustomed to those things. I post regularly on LinkedIn about that, and to get in touch with me, that would be a great way also to have this special offer that you mentioned, Jerry. That the first person who will contact me on LinkedIn and send me a personal message on LinkedIn will receive a signed copy of the book.
So the first three people who contact Alexei on LinkedIn and mention the book. And for organizations out there, you're open, I guess, to coming in and doing workshops and various things for them.
that's a lot of the work that I do, indeed. To come to organization and to, in an entertaining way, because there is some magic and some mentalism, talk about and pretty serious stuff and think that will really help, tools that will really help improve the performance in the company.
Yeah.
And decision making, and collaboration or communication.
And folks out there, if you're looking for a keynote for one of your leadership events or team building events, I've seen Alex speak and he's really good. So it's very entertaining. It's very well done. So I can highly recommend.
And hopefully by the time the podcast is released, the TEDx talk that I've done about that topic about the brain, the illusion that our brain creates, might be out.
Yes.
So at the same time, that your TEDx will be out too, Jerry, because that's how we met for our listeners.
Yes, let's hope. Okay,
yeah.
So Alex, thanks again for sharing your insights, your tips, and your wisdom with both
with
myself
pleasure,
and our listeners today. So, and I look forward to also getting a copy of the book and reading it.
Thank you for having me, Jerry. It was great to be with you. And looking forward maybe to the next episode, when we will speak another time together.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode. You'll find details of what we covered in the show with links, etc., in the show notes. Please share your key takeaways from today's guest and let your friends and colleagues know about the podcast. Oh, and if there's a particular author or leading thinker you'd like me to interview, just get in touch and I'll do my best to get them on the show. This episode was brought to you by Wide Circle, helping you make better talent decisions. To learn more, visit widecircle.eu. That's widecircle.eu. Until next time.